Radio Mano Papachango.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, from sunny, tropical, very, very humid Thailand. This episode features my favorite person on the whole planet Earth, possibly, Dr. Stanley Krippner, who has been on the podcast several times before. But if you're anything like me, you just can't get enough of Stanley. He's 84 years old, I think. I ask him in this episode, maybe 83. In any case, he's in good shape, as you'll hear. Certainly mentally, he's sharp as ever. I've known Stanley 25 years, probably, maybe more. Let's see. I've known Stanley since 1992. So what's that? That's 25 years or 24 years. Yeah. Stanley and I, Stanley is a professor at Sabre Graduate School, where I did my master's and doctoral work. And I knew of him. He's the most famous professor there. He's published, probably pushing 30 books at this point and hundreds of scientific articles, ranging from studies of telepathy to dream interpretation to world mythology to shamanism to healing via altered states of consciousness. This guy, if there's something interesting, he studied it, and he's just so full of fascinating insights and stories and memories, and he's just a wonderful, wonderful man. Anyway, I met him over breakfast within the first couple of weeks of being at Saybrook, and he and I hit it off. He was asking me a lot of questions about what I was doing in Spain, and I explained I was teaching English and this and that. And then I got a note saying that Dr. Krippner would like to meet with me in his office. So I went to his office, and he said, "Well, it sounded to me like you have a pretty flexible life over there in Spain." I said, "Yeah, I do." And he said, "Well, what are you doing in November? Would you like to go to Brazil with me?" And I said, "Well, I'd love to go to Brazil, but, I can't afford a trip to Brazil. I'm teaching English, making next to no money." And he said, "Oh, no, don't worry about that. It's, I'll just ask the organizers of the conferences that I'm going to cover your expenses, and I can pay for your flight with my frequent flyer miles, because I have so many frequent flyer miles because I'm flying around all over the place all the time. And so I can cover your flight." And I said, "Sure." I didn't know him very well, hardly at all. We'd just spoken over breakfast. But I wasn't going to say no to a chance to go to Brazil with Stanley Krippner. So I went to Brazil, and that trip we were in Porto Alegre, which was the first time I tried ayahuasca at a Unio de Vegetal ceremony there. And then we went to Salvador de Bahia, and then we went to Rio. And traveling with Stanley is not like traveling with anyone else. He, because of who he is, he attracts all sorts of interesting people. I remember we went to a candomblé ceremony on that trip. We went to, we were invited to speak with people who were channeling spirits, who went into altered states of consciousness and were channeling spirits and telling us what the spirits were, messages the spirits were trying to tell us. And it was very, fascinating. Anyway, that was the first of many trips I took with Stanley. We became great friends over the years, and we went everywhere. I mean, I've probably been to 30 countries with Stanley if I sat down and added them all up, or at least 30 trips. We've been to India, Morocco, Germany, France. We went to the Lascaux prehistoric cave paintings in France. Argentina, gave at a psychoneuroimmunology conference in Buenos Aires, Venezuela, Mexico, all over the place. And it's been one of the real highlights of my life, being able to spend time with Stanley. And So I apologize if you are a long-term listener and you notice that we might have talked about, you know, told the same story in this episode as in a previous one. But we've known each other so long, it's, you know, it's hard to know what we've talked about on the podcast and what we've just talked about over the years. And in any case, it's just so wonderful to listen to this guy. I just want to hear him tell whatever story he wants to tell me over and over again. So anyway, that's Stanley Krippner. One thing I was thinking about recently, kind of a strange, I don't know, kind of a cantankerous thing. I was watching The Daily Show, probably a month old now, and there was an episode where, I can't remember her name, the tall black woman correspondent goes to this town in upstate New York, where they've got, it's called like Whitesburg or something like that, and they've got the town symbol appears to be a white guy strangling an Indian. This town was briefly in the news a month or so ago because of this seemingly racist symbol. And anyway, she went up to this town to investigate it, and she talked to the mayor, and the mayor explained that actually this was an image from a famous episode in the town's history when the townspeople were trying to improve relations with the Native Americans of the region. And so they held a wrestling competition or something. I imagine this is in the 19th or 18th century. They held this wrestling competition to integrate the people, and it was sort of like a little mini Olympics or something. And so the image was referring to a wrestling match between a white guy and an Indian, and it wasn't what it looked like, which was, you know, obviously it looked like a white guy strangling an Indian. And so when it got to that point, I thought that the piece would be over. Right? That she would say, oh, okay, it's not racist, then sorry. But that's not what happened. She insisted that it was racist. And so the rest of the piece was about why don't you guys change or drop this symbol of your town? Because it seems to be racist, or as she said, because it is racist. And the mayor and the other people she spoke to in the town all said, yeah, but it's not racist. It's not what you think it is. Admittedly, what it could look like to someone who doesn't know the history. But that isn't, in fact, what it's depicting. What it's depicting is the attempt to integrate and improve relations between the Native Americans and the settlers. And so that made me think how, like, her insistence, like, because she was one of these eye rolling, you know, you just don't get it. You need to change this. And it made me feel the way I imagine conservatives often feel when dealing with liberals. I mean, I probably consider myself a liberal, although I think I'm more of a radical than a liberal when it comes to politics. I think, you know, liberals are trying to patch up the system and have it work a little better for everybody, whereas I am pretty much convinced that the system is so deeply flawed that there's no patching that's going to make it work better for everybody. I think it needs to be fundamentally changed. So, which makes me very unrealistic. It makes me an outlier. It makes me, you know, a revolutionary or something. I'm not calling for any bombs or arms or anything like that. But I do think that the system is so deeply fucked that, you know, cleaning it up around the edges isn't really going to do much except perpetuate a system that's deeply fucked. Anyway, I felt like what I imagine conservatives often feel like when they see the liberal press, because she just kept rolling her eyes and saying, no, you don't get it. Oh, you dumb people, you dumb, like, towny, you know, upstate New York idiots. You don't get it. This is racist. You have to change it. But it isn't racist. It looks racist to her, but that doesn't make it racist. She's the one that needs to change. She's the one who needs to say, oh, this isn't what I thought it was. Therefore, I'm wrong. I'm the one who has to change my perception of this, not the thing itself. And I think this is the problem with American society, one of the problems. And yes, I'm going to fucking rant about American society, and I'm sorry. I know that irritates some people, but it's true. American society is all about changing the provocation. It's about not showing nipples on Facebook. It's about not saying the word nigger and saying the N-word instead, even though we all know that the N-word is just another way of saying nigger. It's about not saying cunt and saying the C word instead of cunt. It's fucking stupid, because the problem is not the thing. The problem is the way we respond to the thing. There are ways of saying the word cunt that are incredibly offensive. And there are ways of saying the word cunt that are not offensive, like the way it's said by Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales. That's literature. All right. There are ways of saying the word nigger that are offensive and demeaning and nasty and deserve a fucking slap across the face. No doubt about it. But there are also applications of that word, like, for example, in Huckleberry Finn, which is one of the greatest novels ever written in the English language, and also one of the most heartfelt anti-racist statements that you're ever going to find, certainly in the 19th century. And that whole novel's full of references to Nigger Jim, who is one of the main characters, who's a decent, wise, intelligent man who helps Huck and Tom Sawyer a lot, and who they sort of start the novel seeing as just another slave, and then by the end of the novel they realize the entire institution of slavery is completely fucked up because it reduces somebody like Nigger Jim to a non-human entity, whereas they know he's a wonderful man who treats them better than their own father did, certainly in Huck's case. So my point is, American society gets this wrong. It keeps saying, remove the offending word, remove the offending image, remove the offending thought from the dialogue. Because I'm so goddamn delicate that I can't stand to think about it or hear it or see it. As opposed to, get your shit together. Learn to distinguish between someone who's being an asshole and someone who's just asking a question. Learn to distinguish intention, because that's what it's about. That's why these guys like Rogan and Duncan and other comedians are so against this attempt to control language. Because when you're using it for humor, most of the time you're using it in a healing way. You're lancing a cultural boil. And when we make that illegal or politically incorrect, you can lose your job over shit like this, then we've lost a very important element of the culture's immune system, of the culture's ability to correct itself and heal itself and to move on. That's the problem. We really need to address this. So anyway, I just thought that was a very interesting example of something that's been bugging me a lot. Now, for those of you, I've seen a couple of emails or Twitter things or whatever. People are like, yeah, dude, do you ever say anything nice about America? Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah, I do. Stanley Krippner comes from America. And, you know, Stanley Krippner, I don't think really could exist in any other culture. He comes from the 60s and the 70s, which is a time when America was full of fervor and change and thinking and curiosity and also blood in the streets and tear gas and the Vietnam War. There was a lot going on in those days, and, you know, maybe as much bad as good, but certainly a lot going on. And yeah, America is amazing. America has the most amazing poetry and music, and, you know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in America. But I do think that as a culture, we need to grow up. We need to get past whining and bitching and trying to correct. I mean, I look at Slate, I look at Salon.com, and so many articles, and maybe this is just headline writers in their 20s, I don't know, but so many articles are scoldy. You've been doing this wrong. Here are the 5 things you should never say to a waiter. Here are the 10 things you should never do in an airport. They're all like telling you you're wrong. It's all this scoldy bullshit. And I'm really tired of getting scolded. Every time I go to America, I feel like I'm back in fucking high school. All these tiny, small-brained authority figures who have this structural power, but no power of authenticity, no power of personality. They've never been anywhere. They've never done anything. They're just fucking small-town cops with a heart on, you know, or TSA agents or whatever. Everybody's got a fucking attitude. You go to other countries, you don't get that. You don't get that yelling, line up, take off your shoes. I'm saying, everyone, take this out of your pockets when you come. You don't get that fucking bullshit. It's just a nice guy saying, hey, did you remember to take the thing, take your wallet out? Yeah, don't forget that. You don't get all that attitude. So anyway, all right, sorry, I'm ranting. Anyway, Stanley Krippner, one of my favorite people in the world. I hope you enjoy this. I'm done ranting for a while. I'm sitting on a tropical island in southern Thailand. What the fuck do I have to complain about? Plenty, but I won't do it. Hope you're well. Hope this finds you happy and relaxed. And wherever you are, whatever you're doing while you listen to this, I hope this makes it a little better for you. Thanks. Catch you next week. Here I am with the world famous, esteemed Dr. Stanley Krippner, author of how many books, Stanley?
Well, if you include the ones that I've co-edited and co-authored, about 24.
24 books and several hundred scientific articles. Stanley was my thesis advisor at Saybrook, where I did my master's and PhD. And if you haven't heard the earlier episodes with Stanley, make sure to check the archives, because I think this is probably our fourth or fifth, which makes you the reigning champ.
Oh,
of
good heavens,
tangentially
that's sort of an
speaking.
Honor. I hope I don't run out of things to talk about.
Well, don't worry. I never do. So even when I have shy guests, I just keep yammering and there's no problem. One of our podcasts, I don't know if you remember, we did one in the car.
driving down to San Francisco or to LA. Where you were to appear on Joe Rogan's podcast.
Right.
Yeah. You were, I think you were the first guest that Joe had on by my recommendation. Since then, he's had Dan Savage on, Carl Hart. Do you know him?
Yes.
Carl Hart, the he's a, speaking of drug and alcohol addiction, right, as we were, he's a neuroscientist at Columbia. Who else? He had a, recently he had a woman on who's a humiliatrix, which is a subgenre of dominatrix, of men who particularly enjoy being humiliated. That was an interesting, awkward interview for Joe. I don't think he knew what to do with her. but anyway, so you were the first.
Well, people who I ran into at a exposition said, oh, I know who you are. I heard you interviewed by Joe Rogan.
Yeah. It's a big, he gets about 1 million downloads per episode. That's more than, you know, a lot of TV shows. It's funny because people don't know about podcasts, but the ones that are most popular surpass television in terms of their outreach.
Yeah, they probably don't know about his work in the martial arts.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people, Joe is a very interesting guy because he's so sort of varied in his interests. He was on a couple of TV shows, and now he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, I believe, and now he does commentary for UFC. Do you know about that?
I don't know about that.
UFC is sort of like boxing, but they also kick.
Oh,
it's mixed martial arts, it's called.
Oh, yes, I don't know it by that name, but I know about the kickboxing.
Yeah, so he does the sort of play-by-play analysis of that. So he's, a lot of people only know him through that. Plus, he's a stand-up comic. So people come to his work from all these different directions, and they're always surprised to find all this other stuff going on in his life. Like, for example, his conversation with you. He recently had a guy named Graham Hancock on the you know Graham's? So I met Graham a week ago in Portland, and he mentioned that he doesn't know you personally, but he knows your work, and that you have a lot of friends in common.
We do, yeah.
He mentioned Rupert Sheldrake in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Graham Hancock wrote a book called Fingerprints of the Gods.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think about those? Are you familiar with the theories about the ancient civilization that was wiped out, and then the survivors of that taught the Egyptians and the Incas how to build the temples and monuments and all that? What do you think about these sorts of theories?
You know, I'm a very broad-minded person, so I find them interesting. I have yet to be convinced, but it certainly makes interesting reading.
Yeah.
I think that the major problem that I have is that ideas of this nature often tend to put down the knowledge and the skills of people in early civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they were so bright and so adept, they really didn't need help from extraterrestrials or refugees from Atlantis. I think they could do it on their own. And so that's my particular bias. But like I say, I keep asking, where is the beef? And the Footprints book, which I haven't read but I've heard of, makes a case.
Yeah.
So let's just leave it at that. Makes a case, and a very interesting case.
Yeah, and it's always interesting to revisit the data and sort of see how people can reinterpret it. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not convinced, nor am I ready to dismiss it as nonsense. A lot of it is beyond my comprehension. You know, I don't know the specific dimensions of the pyramids and how that relates to a constellation. And, you know, so I think some of these things, it's difficult because none of us has the time or expertise, or in my case, the brain power to even go into these things deep enough to really check the sources. You know, I'd have to go to Egypt and measure the damn pyramid myself, right? Because, you know, everybody's calling into question the sort of the mainstream analysis of things.
Well, I'm actually more interested in the secrets that the pyramids have yet to teach us. There's a group of Egyptologists who are Egyptians working in Egypt who are now suggesting that there are additional chambers in the pyramids, especially, and in the burial places, especially the burial place of King Tutankhamun, and that perhaps Queen Nefertiti's tomb will be discovered, because she was the most beautiful woman of the world, reputedly of her time, and her bust in the Berlin Museum is world-renowned, and she's been the topic of much speculation. So that'd be incredible if her tomb would be discovered, and if so, there would be any number of treasures in that tomb.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, when I was in the Yucatan visiting the archaeological sites there, our guide pointed out several hills and saying, in these hills, there are probably additional pyramids. We just haven't had the money to uncover them. And I thought, well, if all of the money that the Mexican government had been spending on the ill-fated war on drugs could have been diverted to the pyramids, we would know much more about Egyptian and Mayan and Aztec civilization than we know now.
That's for sure, yeah. It's incredible. I was the other day reading the paper, and on the same page of the New York Times, there was an article talking about how the wait for vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan was over a year for mental health conditions.
Yes.
So a vet suffering from PTSD calls up and says, I'm feeling suicidal, and it takes over a year for him to get an appointment. Mm. And in the same page, there was another article saying that they were almost out of bombs, and that Raytheon and General Electric had to go into overdrive to produce enough bombs to keep bombing ISIS and whomever they're bombing over there. And the funny thing was, like, the whole article about the mental health thing was about how there's not enough money, and where are we going to find money, and we have to pay for it, and da-da-da-da-da. There wasn't a mention of money in the bombing thing.
No.
Just order up more bombs. $1 million each?
Yes.
Yeah, just order what you need, boys.
Yeah, also, more bombing is not the way to fight ISIS. In my opinion, ISIS welcomes the bombing.
They're asking for it. Yeah,
and
literally.
They would love it if America would send troops over.
Yeah.
That would boost their recruitment. The ways to fight ISIS, in my opinion, are number one, cut off the money that comes to them from their bank deposits all over the world, and number two, find employment for the disaffected and alienated young people in the Middle East who turn to ISIS because they have nothing else to do with their lives.
Yeah, yeah, and cut off the oil that they're selling to Turkey.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. What do you think about, are you familiar with the movement toward minimum income? For the idea is that everybody, forget, there's no more welfare, there's no more, you know, social services programs that are specified for this or that, but everybody gets $1,000 a month, tax-free.
I think it works very well in some smaller countries.
Hmm.
It would be a challenge in the United States, which is so large and so diverse. In principle, I like the idea because it takes people off welfare and it gives them a, shall we say, a network of security.
Right. There's a net, a safety net.
Right.
And the common complaint is that then people, it removes the incentive to work. But when it's been introduced, there's been no reduction in people looking for jobs.
Right.
It just takes away a certain desperation.
Sure.
And,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's, it's funny how we're so biased against giving anything. You know, everything needs to be worked for. It's a funny...
It's a Puritan ethic that goes back to the founding of the country.
I think it goes back further than that. I think it's the farming ethic. In Civilized to Death, I break down the farming mindset versus the foraging mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the farming mindset is food must be worked for. You shall earn your bread by the sweat of your brow. right?
Yes.
And nothing's going to be given to you anymore. The God is no longer generous and loving. The God is capricious and jealous and sort of untrustworthy.
In terms of the foraging societies, also the goddess,
right?
You know, the great earth mother was, or the great earth father,
multiple gods
was the giving, bountiful, gracious host. And with the coming of agriculture, for better or for worse, that's when you also had the coming of the more punitive gods.
Yeah.
And so there is a connection there that reverberates to this day.
So this is one of your many areas of expertise, world mythology and origin myths around the world. You knew Joseph Campbell personally, is that right?
Oh, yes. Joseph Campbell was a very dear friend, and his widow, as you might know, was actually and is still a very, very prominent dancer and choreographer.
That's right.
And she is celebrating her 100th birthday in February.
Really?
Yes,
wow.
I've been invited to the event. I don't know if I can go, but I hope it would be possible. At least I will be there in spirit.
Yeah.
I did see her the last time I was in Hawaii, and let me tell you, she is fit as a fiddle. She dances every day.
Really?
I think that there's something to be said for dancing every day, or singing every day, or do something artistic every day as a form of longevity.
Right.
Because I have a friend on the mainland who turned 95 earlier this year, and I actually went to her 95th birthday party where they were performing some of the work that she had choreographed, and she even got up and danced in one of the works herself.
Hmm, that's fantastic.
So, yeah, doing something artistic, something aesthetic, something that gets the body moving and in a joyous way is very, very good for one's health.
Alegría de verte, ay carita de piel morena. Qué alegría de verte, ay carita de piel morena. Y me va dando y me da sonrisa de amor, felicidad. Paseando vamos a la Rambla de Barcelona. Lola y yo paseando vamos a la Rambla de Barcelona. Cogidito, cogidito de la mano. Da que me da, que me da, que me la mano. Atardecer y en esa esquina muerdo su labio. Y un atardecer lluvioso y en esa esquina beso su labio. Y mi mano la acaricia sin pudor. Cali, que cali, que cali, que cali, que cali, mi amor. Entre sabana de seda pasó la noche, me enrea su pelo. Sabana de seda pasó la noche, palpó su pecho. Ay, de sabor y a caramelo se le va un saborcito, mi vida. De que dale, mi amor. Sorpresa de amor, viva Granada.
talking about 100th birthdays, you remind me of...
Her name, by the way, was Anna Halpern, should any of your listeners want to look her up.
Yeah, yeah. And they were married a long time, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You remind me of one of the many wonderful things you finagled an invitation for to me, I mean for me, was Albert Hoffman's 100th birthday. And Cassie and I couldn't come because we had a family visit already arranged. That's one of the things I regret most. You've offered me so many amazing opportunities, and I've tried to take advantage of as many of them as I possibly could, but that's the one that sort of sticks in my throat a little bit.
Oh, good heavens. I was so happy that I was able to go. They actually had me on the program 5 times more than anybody else. Not that I deserved it, but I fell into so many slots. And they actually had me speaking about LSD and parapsychology for a 90-minute time slot.
Wow.
So I thought to myself, you know, I can cover what we know about LSD and parapsychology in 20 minutes. So let me use this opportunity to get some people on the dais who they left out, especially people of color and women who are knowledgeable about the topic. So I invited a woman from Mexico, a psychiatrist from Chile, a psychologist from Colombia to give talks. They should have been on the program in the first place, but they weren't. Another psychologist from Brazil. And so that was a wonderful opportunity to fill the program with a little more diversity than the originators had planned.
Yeah. Well, good for you. You pulled a fast one on them there. I've never thought of that. Take my time and give it to somebody else.
Well, I had been to visit Albert Hoffman just 2 years earlier, and that we had a wonderful visit. We had a great time together. And at that point in time, he had no idea that 2 years from that meeting, the city of Basel and the associated groups would be having this major birthday party for him, which of course was a incredible event. And I was sitting right behind him on the final program where he gave a talk himself. And so the pictures, and people can see this on my website, the pictures have me like looking over Albert's shoulder as he is talking and saying, it's not that I discovered LSD, it's that LSD discovered me.
Right.
And then I chimed in and said it couldn't have discovered a better person.
Yeah. Yeah, you were photobombing him. Yeah. Do you know that expression?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
true.
I heard, maybe you told me this, that he was dancing at his 100th birthday party.
Oh, yes.
That, I'll tell you what, if you're dancing at your 100th birthday party, you've done well.
Exactly.
That's a pretty good thing to be able to put on your resume. Yeah. I was thinking the other day, sort of thinking about getting together with you and how much gratitude I feel for you, all the amazing experiences that you've brought into my life. One of the most amazing was, of course, our visit to Lascaux in France. And I was remembering that day, if I ever write an essay about this, I think the first line will be, one of the most amazing days of my life began with a major fuck-up. Do you remember what I did?
I remember very well, because you were using a motorcycle, so you didn't know much about renting a car. And we had to rent a car to drive to Lascaux in southern France. And so we had everything timed perfectly. We woke up in the morning and went to the car, and you had locked the keys inside the car.
That's right.
It was a Sunday.
It was a Sunday.
Sunday, and the rental agency said, well, we can get somebody there, but it'll take an hour, and it'll cost you an arm and a leg. And I said, well, go for it. And sure enough, an hour almost on the minute, somebody showed up, and in 5 minutes he had the door opened and we took off.
Well, what really had me worried was they said, well, we can send someone out, but if he might not be able to get in which case we'll have to tow the car back and you'll have to come in and get another one. And I thought, well, if that happens, we're going to miss it.
Yeah.
And as it was, we drove, what, 6-7 hours or something
we
to get there.
We drove nonstop.
Nonstop. Didn't stop for lunch.
Didn't stop for food.
I think you had to pee right out the window as we were driving.
Yep.
But I remember we pulled into the parking lot at exactly 3 o'clock or whenever the appointment was, to the point where you jumped out of the car and ran up to the entrance to the cave, didn't even wait for me to like grab the bags and stuff, and I just said, I'll meet you up there, and I arranged things and locked the car, and you went up and held the group for me to
because they were doing the roll call.
Yeah.
And after I arrived, and they said, Dr. Stanley Krippner and guest, I said, here.
Wow.
But that wasn't the end of the remarkable things. Of course, seeing the caves was incredible. It was one of the great archaeological and artistic experiences of my life. And after it was over, this lovely young woman came up and said, are you Stanley Krippner, who has written books? And I said, yes, I guess I am. And she said, oh, I'd love to talk to you. Where are you staying tonight? And I said, well, you know, we didn't have time to get a hotel. She said, well, why don't you and your friends stay with me at my chateau?
Yeah, I remember.
So we went to her chateau, and she fixed a lovely French soup for us and sandwiches. Yeah. And she says, I have to go to a party now, but you can make yourself at home.
Yeah.
She had a whole library of books about cave paintings.
When she arranged for the French expert of Lascaux, who had built the replica museum, to come to the house and spend a couple hours chatting with us and answering all our questions. And I think the party she was going to, the prime minister was going to be there or something. Right. She couldn't beg off.
Right.
Yeah, that was incredible. I remember in the car, well, two things I remember about her was she was so impressed to meet you, and then you introduced me, and she looked at me and just sort of like went, and then turned back to you like I was non-existent. She wasn't impressed by me. And then I remember driving, following her to her place. We were both sort of like, well, is this woman for real, or is this some sort of crazy neurotic situation? And we'd worked out a safe word. Remember where we were going to go in, and if one of us said the safe word, that meant like, okay, we're going to make an excuse and get out of here. But it turned out to be wonderful. It was a huge, I have pictures of you prancing around in her mink coat. Do you remember that? We
found the
mink coat.
I have one of those pictures, and I could not remember where I ever got into a mink coat. Now you've answered the question.
That was it. Yeah, we found the mink coat, and you were prancing around. I took some pictures. It was, if I remember, I'll post those on my webpage for people listening to this. They can see Stanley Krippner in a French millionaire's mink coat.
The one transvestite experience of my later life.
Really? Later life. I like that. Qualify it. That was funny. So many places that you facilitated for me. We went to Brazil and Argentina. I was talking about my public speaking nightmare in Argentina. That was as nervous as I've ever been. I mean, I've spoken to much bigger crowds and much more sort of venerable venues, but you invited me to come to Argentina to a conference on psychoneuroimmunology.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that we were going to be talking to about 30 hippies sitting on pillows on the floor. And I remember they let us, when we first arrived, they took us to show us the venue. And it was this big theater. And there were going to be 2,000 doctors there the first day. And then the next day, it was going to be 5,000 open to the public. And there was going to be TV. And I remember in the elevator back at the hotel saying to you, I don't think I can do this. And I had to do it in Spanish. And I was so nervous. And I remember you're the most gentle, friendly guy I know, but you just said, well, you better do it. you put the hammer down on me.
Oh, yes, that was tough love.
That was some tough love, yeah. Yeah, that's as scared as I've ever been. We were there on stage with Robert Ader. You remember him?
Yes. Robert Ader, for your listeners' elucidation, is one of the founders of the field of psychoneuroimmunology. And that was a very, very important meeting because we got along quite well at that meeting. And then a few months later, I was actually invited to write an article about psychoneuroimmunology for an encyclopedia. And so I did some writing and I sent it to Robert Nader and asked for his feedback. And he went through and he completely updated and revised that entry. And so that particular entry was so accurate and so good that when they did a second edition of the encyclopedia a few years down the line, I simply used a few references to update it, but I used the same article. Nobody knows why that was so authentic, and so I got compliments and plaudits that I really didn't deserve, but that's besides the point. I was just happy to get the accurate information out there.
Well, you know, part of being in a person in your position is knowing the right people to turn to make sure you're right about things like
that. Yes, that's very important.
You know, sometimes it's who you know rather than what you know. Do you know Wim Hof? Have you heard of him? The Dutch guy. He's a very interesting guy. He had a tragedy early in his life. His wife committed suicide and he had this terrible emotional trauma. And he found that the only thing that really brought him relief was exposing himself to extreme cold temperatures.
No, I don't know this story.
Well, he's gone on, now he's probably in his 50s or maybe 60s, and he's gone on to do things like climb Mount Everest in shorts, run a marathon in winter above the Arctic Circle, again in shorts. He's got all the world records for sitting in ice water for 2 hours and swimming under icebergs and just all this incredible body control, autonomic nervous system control through his conscious mind. I was listening to a podcast with him the other day, and he talked about how he participated in a study done at a medical school in Holland where they injected him with pathogens, and then he was able to control his white blood cell count and all these different measures. And he said, you know, the first time in history this has ever been done. And I thought, this guy doesn't know about psychoneuroimmunology.
Right.
So I'm going to go to Holland and interview him and bring him some of Robert Ader's research and some of this other stuff, because I think he doesn't know that people have been looking into these issues quite a while
right
now.
Also, the story that you've just told indicates something your listeners will be interested in. When you are overcome with grief, the way to handle that is not to become an alcoholic or become a drug addict. It's to turn to your own bodily resources. And in his case, extreme sports is what helped him survive and work his way through. Other people might do some sort of meditation or yoga or some other less extreme form of exercise. But movement, exercise, dance, singing, chanting, all of those are very, very healthy ways of helping people cope with extreme emotional distress.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the impulse many people have is to close down and shut the gates
right
because so much pain has just come in. But the problem with that is that then the pain is trapped inside.
Of course, the better alternative is to open up, and that's what you do by singing, by chanting, by dancing, by extreme sports, and all of that.
And in some cases by altering your consciousness, as we're talking about with meditation and dancing and things like that. One of the arguments I make in Civilized to Death involves the use of hallucinogens. And I feel like we're at a turning point now in American culture and maybe world culture where, you know, you remember, you're old enough to remember when, you know, Albert Hofmann was able to, he personally wasn't supplying them, but Sandoz was supplying LSD to psychiatrists and psychologists for their own personal research, psychotomimetic research. But now, for the first time since back then, in what, the early 60s, when they were sort of prohibited, they're coming back into use in clinical settings and in research. I think it's a very interesting pivot point when our society's been so terrified of these substances, and now for the first time you're starting to see them being re-examined and re-accepted in a way. What do you think?
Well, of course, it comes too late to help a number of people who could have been helped 20 years ago, but you know, better late than never. One of the most interesting developments is called microdosing.
Yeah.
And the person who introduced that term was Jim Fadiman, a longtime friend of mine. And people who have access to pretty pure LSD and people who are inventors or creators or even people in the higher echelons of the dot-com industries take a small amount of LSD every week, and they claim that that helps sharpen their facilities and give their imagination a boost.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting how big a role these things have played in, even in conventional American society, but it's sort of unspoken and quiet. Steve Jobs said one of the most important experiences he ever had that opened his creativity was the use of LSD.
That's right. Years ago, I was invited to a dinner with Sir Francis Crick and his wife.
Right, the discoverer of DNA, co-discoverer.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was asking him how come he was able to discover it and beat Linus Pauling, who was working on the same issue. And so he talked about how he had technology that Linus Pauling did not have, and he had the benefit of subsequent research. But then he made a statement. He said, and also I had some special resources of my own, and I didn't think to push that, but now in retrospect, I know he was talking about his use of LSD while he was working on the double helix.
To sort of, to break open the creative process, subconscious. Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced DMT?
Oh, years ago, yes.
Oh, really? Not in ayahuasca, but the purified form?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
How did you find that? I've never tried that.
Well, it was a vivid but very short-term experience.
Mm-hmm.
Lasted about an hour, but I still can remember the imagery and the effect it had upon me. But, you know, the images were so colorful and so vivid that they do bear a resemblance to the color and the vivid of the ayahuasca images.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably something that DMT in whatever form is able to do.
Right, right. It has triggers the same sorts of visual hallucinations.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's an endogenous chemical, I believe. It exists in minute amounts in the brain.
Yes,
naturally.
It is.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. You knew, I'm just looking at your bookshelf here while we're chatting, I see the Don Juan papers. You knew Castaneda.
I met right? Castaneda.
You met him, yeah.
But the Don Juan papers are by Richard D. Mill, who was the chief critic of Castaneda.
Okay.
And also the son of Cecil B. DeMille, the Hollywood director.
Oh, right.
And producer. Very, very bright and interesting man, and he gave an invited address for the American Psychological Association's Division of Humanistic Psychology, and I invited him because I thought that it would be interesting to hear his take on Castaneda. And after talking about how he analyzed the Castaneda chronology and found out it didn't make sense, and how he investigated the anthropological basis of the supposed Don Juan Mattis, and it didn't make sense. He talked about his meeting with Castaneda at an Anthropological Association convention, and Castaneda told Emil, you know, it's nice to meet you, and you're the only one at this convention that'll talk to me. Everybody else is keeping their distance from me. And so, despite the fact that they had this potentially acrimonious relationship, they ended up going to the bar together and having a good conversation.
Really? Oh, that's nice. Yeah, bars at conferences are a good place to sort of make up.
Well, an example of that is when Rupert Sheldrake was invited to give a talk on telepathy at the Science of Consciousness conferences at Tucson, Arizona, which are held every 2 years. And Christoph Koch, a German neuroscientist, bitterly opposed it. He was to the point of saying, you know, I'm not going to attend if you have Sheldrake talking on this pseudoscience. Well, Christoph Koch came anyway, and it ended up that Sheldrake and Koch actually had enjoyable conversation at the bar.
Well, Cassie and I went to a conference in Mexico a couple of years ago, where it sort of became famous because I think it was the last place where Richard Dawkins and Deepak Chopra ever shared the stage.
Oh my.
Yeah, you can imagine that. That was not a very fruitful conversation. But we were there, and some of the people whose work we critique in Sex at Dawn were there, like Helen Fisher and what's the name of the guy from Texas? David Buss. They were there, and you could just see that they were just very unhappy that we were invited, that I was invited. They didn't know Casilda. So Casilda went and sort of charmed their socks off before they knew who she was, and then the two of us showed up later, obviously together, and then it was too late for them to be angry with her. And so I sort of managed to slip into the conversation at the bar. And by the end of the night, we were all laughing and having a good time. You know, it's. I mean, I think there are scientists who are willing to maintain some separation between their idea and their ego, and there are scientists who let their idea and their ego merge. And that's where it gets really dangerous, because you can't possibly be wrong. Your idea can't be wrong, because then you are wrong. There's something wrong with you and your entire career. And one of the things I like about your approach to work is that you maintain a lot of distance between the thing you're studying and your own personal ego. You don't seem to have a lot invested in whether this turns out to be true or not true, if a particular psychic is really a psychic or a trickster, or, you know what I mean?
No, I just let things fall to places as they will, and I'm just interested in finding out what's happening, and I really don't have a personal investment in it. And I think that's one thing that helps me to get along quite well with people who might be opposed to some of the conclusions I've drawn. Albert Ellis is one of the earliest critics of parapsychology, by the way. And he and I became very close friends. And at the end of his life, he was telling his wife, in embarrassingly glowing terms, how I was one of the few people who had not deserted him, who had not let him down, when the Albert Ellis Institute's board of directors kicked him out of his own building. And I came to his support, and I was vindicated, because when that went to court, he was reinstated. Of course, by that time he'd run out of money, he'd run out of energy, so it's what we call a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah.
But I always got along quite well with Al for decades and decades, and we had more interesting things to talk about than parapsychology, where we did have agreement.
What's happening in the field of parapsychology now? Is it still... is it thriving? Is it dwindling? What's going on there?
You know, it's so interesting, because there are more books now being published, serious books, in the field of parapsychology than I've ever seen. There's a huge encyclopedia of parapsychology that's just come out. There's a two-volume work on parapsychology that was edited by Ed May, who was in charge of the government's espionage program that was terminated by all people by Robert Gates, who became Secretary of Defense under both Bush and Obama.
Was that the men who stare at goats, that program?
It was that program, yeah, was part of it.
Right.
And the movie, The Man Who Stared at Goats, was based on a true life incident, much distorted, but the George Clooney character is actually Colonel John Alexander, who's a close friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, John didn't think too much of the movie. He thought it could have been better. But yes, that's the same program.
Although, you know, how upset can you be if George Clooney is playing you?
That's what he said. He said it was such a great compliment to have George Clooney play him in the movie that he was not going to make harsh comments about it.
Did you read the book, John Ronson's book, The Men Who Stare at Goats?
I never read it, no.
It was an interesting book. I enjoyed it. It's humorous, but it wasn't... I felt that the movie took humor and turned it into goofiness. And it removed the sense that there was some scientific endeavor going on there. Yeah, I wasn't thrilled by the movie either.
Well, John Alexander is a very, very sharp thinker, and he writes policy papers for various foreign affairs journals, and he has come out with one paper which is absolutely stunning, because we were talking about ISIS. He sees how one can look at ISIS through the eyes of chaos theory and self-organization, and from that point of view, it doesn't matter how many leaders you kill, because it's like a hydra. Another leader will come and take its place. And you don't have a hierarchical, linear cause and effect. ISIS encourages people to go off on their own and commit random acts of violence. And so the strategy that's being used is old-fashioned. It's not non-linear, and that's what ISIS is. It's a very non-linear organization, and the movement appeals to people who do not think rationally or linearly, or who by virtue of circumstance don't have any place else to go or anything else to do with their lives. So getting back to Alexander, yes, he's a very, very original thinker, and he and his wife travel the globe engaging in discoveries and new adventures. And then he uses that as grist for the mill for some of his insightful articles.
Well, that's not a bad gig.
Not at all.
That sounds like a pretty good way to arrange things. That's sort of what we aspire to, right?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That was Casilda giving us a kiss. We don't know why exactly.
I better take a picture there.
And take a picture of us, too.
I'm ready to.
Oh, okay, good.
Oh, well, a little bit of erotic stimulation keeps us going. Better to give it that.
That was our... took a little kiss break there.
Yes, the erotic highlight of my week.
Mine, too.
Yes, Stanley, you are an encyclopedia.
An encyclopedia. A living encyclopedia. Exactly.
Yes. I'm sorry about that.
So let's turn to, I sort of get a little panicked because I know you have met so many interesting people, and, you know, I always think, like, I wonder if Stanley knew this person. I wonder if Stanley ever met this person. I was watching a documentary recently called The Source Family. Do you know about that?
Yes.
And Father Yod?
Yes.
Did you ever meet them?
No, I know the story.
Oh, okay. All right. Because I may interview a woman who was part of that.
Oh, really?
And have you seen the film?
No.
It's a fascinating film.
Love to see it.
Oh, it's a really interesting film. Yeah. Yeah, I won't talk about it because some people listening to this might want to go see it. I don't want to ruin the ending. But you think you know how it's going to end, and it doesn't. What about, you have any exposure to the Manson family or any of these famous 60s situations?
Just very indirectly. I was on the editorial board of the now defunct Journal of Psychosomatic Dentistry and Medicine. And David Smith, who founded the free clinic during the 1960s, which is still
going on Haight Street. In the Haight District?
In the Haight District,
right.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Andrew Weil worked there.
Yes, he did. And it really served the needs of many, many young people who had come to San Francisco and were too poor to take adequate care of their health, and so he got some financial backing to support the free clinic, did very innovative work there. Nonetheless, he was invited to visit this commune, and he didn't know it at the time, but this was the infamous Charles Manson commune. And so he wrote a description of the commune, disguising the names of the people, and it was published in our journal. And that's actually a historic document, because a couple of years down the line, they were engaged in murdering Sharon Tate and her friends, and that led to Charles Manson now being in jail, and his partners in crime being in jail. One of them, who claims she has completely reformed her life, and apparently she has, still is being denied parole.
Mm.
And also, of course, it led to one of the survivors of that commune trying to assassinate President Ford when he was in San Francisco.
Lynette Squeaky Frome.
Yes, Lynette Squeaky Frome, and she has been immortalized in this marvelous musical by Stephen Sondheim, Assassins.
Oh, really? I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, there's this one duet between the two women who tried to kill Ford, and they have a duet together how this is the only way that they will be able to be known and have their names become part of history.
Hmm.
It's a charming, ironic, satirical commentary on fame. And of course, the other woman who tried to assassinate Ford was deflected by a man who bumped her elbow and sent the gun off into the street. And he was never properly acknowledged because it turned out that he was gay.
Really?
Oh, yes. Back in those days, that would have been embarrassing. I do have to give President Ford credit, though. He did write a very warm letter to the man.
So the man was in Secret Service. He was a civilian.
No, this was a civilian.
And he saw her pull the gun. No kidding. Wow. Because he was gay. That he wasn't acknowledged.
Now, of course, he'd be an icon.
Yeah.
Times have changed so much.
Yeah.
But back in those days, he was not properly recognized. It was investigative reporters who found this out, but this was, again, something that didn't hit the front pages of the newspaper.
Right. You know, you and I were talking earlier in the car about sort of a historical perspective on this moment culturally, and I think you said, I was asking if things are always strange or if this is stranger than normal, and I think you said it's always strange, but this is stranger than normal. Do you feel, I mean, how old are you, 86, 85? 83. Mm-hmm. Good, 83. With that perspective, do you feel like, can you identify a certain trajectory of American culture, or is it just random craziness?
Yes, American culture is nonlinear.
Nonlinear, okay. So
there's the good and there's the bad. Yeah. Like Charles Dickens famously wrote, these were the best of times, they were the worst of times.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of Lily Tomlin's famous line, which I heard her utter when she did a one-woman show several years ago, just when you think that things can't get any worse, they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that there are inherent dangers now in terms of terrorism breaking out in unexpected places. That's unpredictable. It's unlinear, so people have a right not to feel completely safe. But on the other hand, that's what the terrorists want. They want people to be afraid. So the best antidote that people can do on a personal basis is simply get on with their lives.
Do you have any, and this is a very strange thing to be saying, but I have, I wouldn't say sympathy, but I have some I don't know, commonality, I guess, with the apocalyptic cult kind of approach that ISIS and others take, in the sense, only in one sense, that they have an extreme critique of civilization. And it seems to me that what they're doing is the same thing that street gangs in South Central Los Angeles are doing, or sports fanatics. They're looking for meaning, and they're not finding meaning in the sort of daily reality of their lives. And so they're finding it in extreme religious interpretation and a rejection of modernity, because modernity has failed them.
Yes.
So I feel that, I mean, you know, obviously I don't support any terrorist group or, you know, in any sort of practical way or even philosophical way, but I think I understand the motivation that they look at modernity and they say, particularly Western materialist culture, and they say, that's not it. We don't want that. And yet you're forcing it on us. You're bringing in your TVs and your drones and you're, you know, opening the markets. And I can understand the feeling in the Middle East of feeling oppressed by Western society.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. And I agree with you. I don't agree with their behavior or their attitudes. But I can understand the reaction against Western modernity, because at the end of the day, what has it brought those people? They're not a part of the ruling class. They're not members of the 1% or even the top 5%, and they feel imposed on, and they feel marginalized, and this is one way for them to find meaning in their life, either as a member of an apocalyptic sect, which is seeing the end of the world as being nigh, or a terrorist sect, which is saying we've got to rebel against Western modernity, and if we take down some civilians, well, that's the price I have to pay for being a part of it.
Right. And of course they can justify it because they look in their own countries and they see civilians being killed all the time by drones, by American bombing, by all mm-hmm. sorts of stuff. Yeah, Americans are very naive, I think. This whole idea of they hate us for our freedoms, you know, they don't. Yes. Yeah, let's talk about the dictatorship that we installed in Saudi Arabia, for example. You know, most of the terrorists are Saudis, at least in 9/11.
Most of them are. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we won't get into that quagmire. But when you look at the situation,
I wouldn't say that we installed the dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. I would say that we supported it. And it's a very complicated situation because on the one hand, Saudi women are now allowed to vote. They're allowed to run for office. Things are a little better for women in Saudi Arabia than they have been. I think that on the other hand, Saudi Arabia wants to be the predominant power in the Middle East, so they're having a rival with Iran. And so the United States is a position of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You support an agreement with Iran against them enhancing their nuclear capacity, and this makes the Saudis very, very happy. But then you enlist the Saudis and give them arms for fighting some of the allies of the Iranians, and then that makes them angry. So the situation is, I think, more complicated than any of the American leaders since the Second World War have been able to fathom.
Yeah.
I think that the last positive thing that the United States did in that region that makes sense was under Eisenhower, when he told the British and French to withdraw their forces from the Suez Canal and give it back to Egypt.
Right.
Yeah, that was a masterstroke. Since that time, it has been one blunder after another, and probably the worst blunder was when George W. Bush's deputy Paul Brenner.
Yeah.
Bonner took over Iraq and dismantled the Imperial Guard that was supporting Saddam Hussein. Well, those were Sunnis, and they didn't have jobs, they didn't have position, they didn't have power, and now a number of them are fighting for ISIS.
They had guns and they had military training.
That's right.
Yeah. It was Brenner, Paul Brenner. Yes. Yeah, dipshit who wore the combat boots with his suits all
that's
the time.
That's right.
Thought he was a tough guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, idiot. Yeah, yeah, American politics is very depressing and very strange. Being back in America, I don't know if you ever had these dreams, but I used to have dreams my high school contacted me and said, hey, you didn't finish. You there are two more credits you need to get. You have to come back to high school. And I'd be 30 years old back in high school, you know, doing my gym class or something. I had this, it was a recurring nightmare I had for a while. And coming back to America feels like that. It's like, it's there are these strange authority figures that I feel no reason to take seriously other than the fact that everyone expects you to take them seriously. It's a strange, it's a very rule-based society and seems to be like fearful of things getting out of control, you know? And I think this relates back to what we were saying earlier about European societies where there's a entrenched tradition. People aren't, it seems like there aren't as many rules because everyone sort of knows how to behave, you know, because for generations we've all been Spaniards and we Spaniards do things in certain ways. It's a, America is a very interesting place because of the need for all those rules, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, have you ever, you've never lived outside of the U.S., have you?
No, I've visited over 100 different countries, but I've never lived extensively there like you have and Casola has.
Yeah. Have you been tempted? Have you ever thought, no, this is a place I'd like to stay?
Yes, I've been tempted. I actually think now it's too late, and when my wife was alive, it's something that never would have appealed to her. She was always eager to get back to the United States after our travels in other countries. But I have any number of friends who are what we call expatriates who are now living abroad, mainly in Western Europe and in Canada.
Yeah. Interesting times in Canada, too. You saw their new premier, Trudeau.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, interesting guy.
Yes, Trudeau is, for better or for worse, really, really going to shake things up.
Yeah. So what are you working on now? You mentioned earlier you're in the middle of a writing project.
I'm actually working on Saybrook University student papers because the end of the semester is coming up and they have to finish their coursework or re-enroll next semester, which will cost them extra money. And then I am doing some writing projects. I, as you know, have finished the second Rolling Thunder book, and this is with the publisher waiting for it to be copy edited.
Ah, good.
So that's on its way. I am working with a former student of mine on a book on interpreting dreams and nightmares. We are presenting different schools of thought, the psychoanalytic tradition, the psychodynamic tradition, the cognitive behavioral condition position, the humanistic position, the transpersonal position, etc., etc., etc. But the catch is, each chapter has to deal with how they handle post-traumatic stress disorder nightmares. There's a handful of worthwhile books and articles on it, just a handful. And now that the chapters are coming in, we find that most of the authors really have not given that a lot of thought. And it's about time, because with all of the combat veterans coming back with PTSD, virtually all of them have repetitive nightmares as part of the syndrome. and their psychotherapists don't know how to handle these nightmares, except to give more medication. And yet, if they're able to crack through the nightmares and help the brain process the traumatic experience and get the very literal nightmares turned into symbolic nightmares, the way that most dreams take on symbolic characteristics, then that can start a cascading effect that would help to unravel the knots that PTSD has gotten these people tied up in.
Yeah.
So that's a worthwhile book, and we're nearing the deadline for our publisher. So after you leave today, I'll be getting back to that book and working on it.
Oh, really?
Yes, but then I'm working on another book that I'll probably have some questions for you about with all of your expertise. And this is one that a friend of mine has gotten me involved in, Sex and Love in the Bay, a book written for her high school and undergraduate students who have questions about sex and love.
In the Bay?
Yes, in the Bay Area.
The Bay Area, huh?
Because the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, is very unique in many, many ways. So it has a particular target audience. And I have actually found the approach of your friend Dan Savage is very, very useful, where people will ask questions and he'll come out with very excellent but very outrageous answers. So much of the book is actual questions the students have asked, and then we are giving answers and, you know, basing them on sexual science, on sexology and what we actually know about sex and love, not only on the Bay, but in general. So that's a project that's actually enjoyable to write and languishing while some of these other projects are moving along. I have several book chapters I'm struggling with because the deadline is coming due. So yes, I've got enough writing projects to keep me busy.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, listen, I've taken up an hour of your time. I don't want to take up too much more. Do you have any, I know I ask you this every time we get together, but, and maybe this is a pain in the ass for, you know, as you get older, people keep asking you for advice. Is that a pain in the ass?
Not at all.
No?
Because I tell them that I can't guarantee that I will have any useful information. So you take what you get.
People expect, you know, an elder to have some sort of pearls of wisdom to bestow upon them. I don't know. That, maybe that's an unfair expectation. I know, I feel when people ask me for advice, I always feel inadequate to the task. Do you have advice? A lot of people listen to this are in their 20s and 30s, sort of starting out in life, and they don't want to make any mistakes, and, you know, they're torn between security and adventure and all those typical things.
Well, yes, I would go back to evolutionary psychology and have them remember that the human brain and the human organism and the human psyche did not evolve to find truth. It evolved to find meaning. It evolved to find meaning in their lives. And once you had meaning, then you protected yourself, your family, your children, your spouse, your community, your tribe, to keep them going so that they would survive. And survival is the bottom line of human evolution. Now, sometimes people believe in the strangest, most weird things, but those strange beliefs have given meaning to their lives and have kept them going.
Right.
However, we're now at the point in our evolution where truth is really essential, because unless we, for example, know the facts of what's happening in the Middle East, unless we know the facts of what's going to help us keep healthy and keep fit, unless we know the facts of what's going to keep us free of sexually transmitted infections, and not follow the dogma of a church or a religion or a political party or a prejudice or an ethnic bias, we are going to be in great trouble. This is the need for critical thinking, for creative thinking, for mindfulness approaches to daily life, to help us to live life fully, but without the constraints imposed upon us by an ethnic, religious, or political group, which might take us astray and, in the long run, get us to do things that are going to be bad for ourselves and for society.
Right. Yeah. That's good advice. One of the few strands of good news that I follow, or hopefulness that I follow, is things like a podcast where, you know, we can sit down and you can just speak right from the heart, and there's no publisher, there's no censors, there's no TV executive between you and the audience. I think that's sort of a revolutionary thing, and
it's
mm-hmm. I think it's on par with the invention of the printing press in terms of changing society. I think the repercussions will be huge if things last long enough for it to take effect. But we'll see.
Well, communication is very central, because communication has as one of its side effects collaboration and mutual survival benefits.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Stanley. I expect to be dancing with you at your 100th birthday party in, what, 17 years?
Thank you. Yeah. We'll hope that we're here and that the world is still here at that
exactly.
point in time.
Thanks, Stan.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation and appreciate your support for the podcast, especially those of you who do it through fundwhatyoulove.com, where you can set it up to take $1, $5, $10, whatever you can afford, whatever you feel motivated to throw at the podcast every month. You don't have to think about it. It's an ongoing thing. You can cancel at any time, of course. That's fundwhatyoulove.com. That's run by Danny Osman, who also does the sound engineering for the show. You can find him at emeraldcitypro.com if you have any engineering, sound engineering needs. He's great. I vouch for him, of course. He's been doing the sound engineering for this podcast for over a year now, completely voluntarily. He's a cool guy. So if you have any business you want to throw his way, please do. Thanks to Basin and Range for the opening music. You can find them at basinandrangeband.com. There's a Reddit, tangentially speaking, discussion group. If you want to talk about episodes, throw a question at me, get a conversation started at Reddit, just do a search for tangentially speaking, all one word. And of course, thanks to Bennett at Shore Design T-Shirts, another guy who's been supporting this podcast from the very beginning when I had about 15 listeners. He was there. He's still there. And I love him. Never met the guy, but I love him. And I sure as hell love his shirts. So you can get his shirts at shoredesignt-shirts.com. And of course, all the shirts that are at chrisryanphd.com are made by Shore Design T-Shirts in Thailand and packaged and shipped to you by my mom, Julie. Say hi to Julie if you order anything. She loves it when that happens. And of course, last but not least, thanks to Carsey Blanton for the song you're about to hear, Smoke Alarm, which reminds you to carpe fucking diem, because you're going to die one day.
He said, baby, what's a big deal? Feel what you want to feel. Say what you want to say. You're going to die one day. For example, I could kiss you just because I want to. What's the difference if you turn away? I'm gonna die one day. Why do you waste your time thinking about your reputation? Trying to meet an expectation, wondering what they're gonna say. Headed for a headstone. I don't want to give the end away, but we're gonna die one day. Your body is an animal, doesn't ask for much. A little music and a soft touch. Why don't you let it out to play? Your heart is in a birdcage, singing in your chest. You wanna shut it up but give it a rest. You're gonna die one day. Why do we waste our time thinking about a reputation? Running from a confrontation, wondering what we ought to say. wanna feel, spend the night with me. I'm gonna take you up in my arms, and if we must go down, we'll go singing to the smoke alarms. We'll dance into the ground.